Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin. On today's program, we address the rise of political protests early in the Donald Trump presidency with focus on the most recent incidents at UC Berkeley, where the provocative far-right Breitbart writer Milo Yiannopoulos' speech was canceled after mass protests erupted on campus. Historian, journalist, and San Francisco Chronicle columnist David Talbot joins the conversation. Later in the program, Arif Humayun, the author of Connivance by Silence, a co-founder and president of Circle of Peace and a fellow at the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, joins the program to talk about his work, which is dedicated to understanding what causes radicalization and advancing human rights. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin. In this segment of the program today, we are going to be discussing the recent activities that have taken place around the country in protests surrounding the presidency of Donald Trump. But more specifically, we're going to be looking at incidents that took place at the University of California, Berkeley, where the provocative far-right Breitbart writer Milo Yiannopoulos, his speech was canceled after mass protests erupted on campus. And for the first segment here today, we're joined by historian and San Francisco Chronicle columnist David Talbot to talk about these issues and the many different approaches and dialogue that we're seeing built around these kind of responses, these protests, violence versus nonviolence, and so forth. So here's my co-host Peter Phillips to introduce David to you. Peter?
David Talbot is a longtime San Franciscan journalist and author. His book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles of the CIA, The Rise of America's Secret Government, was a New York Times bestseller. David was founding pioneer on the news site Salon and was editor of the San Francisco Examiner and has published the New York Times, The Guardian, and The New Yorker. His columns run now three times a week at the San Francisco Chronicle. David, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, David Talbot, you have been active on social media, on your Facebook page, talking about the recent incidents at the University of California, Berkeley, where there was mass resistance and protest that did involve what appeared to be some degrees of violence or setting of fires, these types of things that ultimately ended up leading the university to cancel a talk by Breitbart.com writer Milo Yiannopoulos. And Milo has been in the news for some time for various types of very provocative behavior, trolling behavior online, and so forth. So he evokes quite a visceral response in people wherever he goes. But David Talbot, could you wade us into this subject, and then we'll have a conversation about the many different perspectives and interpretations?
Well, there's a lively debate already on the left about the reaction to Milo Yiannopoulos, and specifically the Berkeley protest, which, as you say, shut him down. Many people who believe in the pure free speech, including some veterans of Berkeley's famous free speech movement, who recently wrote an article in the Daily Cal, the student newspaper at Berkeley, criticizing the protesters for shutting down Yiannopoulos on free speech grounds. I disagree with that because I believe, unfortunately, we're not living in a liberal democracy anymore. We're not living in the sort of civics class version of America that we were taught, where the free-for-all of discourse and free expression somehow arrives at a position of reason and justice. Unfortunately, we live, I think, in a pre-fascist or emerging fascist society at this point, and someone like Milo Yiannopoulos should not just be seen as some ordinary private citizen or public figure. He, in fact, as a prominent editor and the most prominent face of Breitbart News, essentially function as a front man for the semi-official propaganda arm of the administration of the Trump presidency, which, of course, is essentially run by the former chief executive of Breitbart News, Steve Bannon. So this was an effort to shut down hate speech. That's the way I see it. This is a young man who, for his own narcissistic, self-promotional, vain reasons, goes around stirring up hatred and vilifying our most vulnerable members of our society, writing articles excusing slavery and so on, you know, mocking the weakest and most vulnerable, and inviting their victimization. Well, that's hate speech. And in many advanced democracies like Germany that have unfortunate historic lessons taught them, this kind of speech is not defined as free speech. It's precluded from those constitutional protections. And I believe that given the perilous state that this country is in now, the country that's flying apart by the hour, literally, that's fragmenting our civil society because of this extremist presidency, this extremist government that has taken over, that we are no longer in the kind of privileged position of holding on to these niceties and norms of the past. As I say, we're fighting an emerging fascist government, and in that case, we have to counter hate speech as militantly as we can. Now, that doesn't mean I endorse violence. And the black bloc, so-called black bloc, anarchistic sort of street, you know, wild in the street stuff that happens in Berkeley is wrong because it only is counterproductive and it invites further repression and it isolates protesters from the rest of the country.
David, can I jump in here? Because that would be great to follow up that subject of black bloc and violence when and if it is ever appropriate. But we can speak about that in a moment. But to address, this is Michael here, to address your issue about the country coming apart and whether this is a moment to challenge fascist, proto-fascist, Nazi-type forces, nip them in the bud before they get a chance to air their views and before a guy like Milo gets to stand up before hundreds of people and air his toxic views. I really agree with you on that. I do think it is a moment when people need to come out and hit fire with fire and punch hard the way Trump has solidly been punching the last several weeks that he's been in office. What's interesting is that throughout Trump's campaigns and all of his rallies, anyone who voiced dissent or any even protester who showed up was either booed or more often physically threatened, thrown out, and Trump made the actual point, punch this guy in the nose, get this guy out of here. That was a hallmark of Trump's entire presidential campaign, which freaked the press out and freaked America out that this is a guy running for president who openly declares, kick this guy, beat him up, get him out of here if he dissents. So isn't that ironic? And, you know, of course, the right-wing press now picks this story up as heart of the free speech movement, Berkeley, you know, censoring free speech. But really, this is just using basically Trump tactics back on his people. You see it as something like that?
Yeah, I mean, look, hate speech is not free. It comes with a steep cost because they're victims often of free speech, as we again have seen historically. It has to be opposed by more civilized people up to the point of violence. As I say, I don't agree with the violent reaction to violent speech, but I do believe that it should be militantly opposed. And everything short of sort of the black bloc stuff that happened in Berkeley, I support loud chanting, stomping, people who circle a building and prevent Milo Yiannopoulos' idiotic fans from filing into the building to listen to him. Yes. Why should a propagandist for this extremist, abnormal presidency be allowed to keep spewing his poison all around the country, including our own communities? Libertarians, civil liberty advocates, I understand their position. I myself, as a journalist, have held to these positions and these principles throughout my life. But now that I see, actually, from my own studies as a scholar, I wrote this book, as you said earlier, about Alan Dulles, the man who, through his own dark behavior as one of our key national security figures, injected some of this fascist poison into our country. You see how this kind of poison can grow if it's not countered with the same kind of force that these people injected into our nation's bloodstream.
Hi, this is Peter Phillips. Steve Bannon and Milo Yiannopoulos are buddies. They work together. So hate speech coming onto our campuses and coordinated with the government really needs to be repressed and not violently, but strongly opposed. How do you feel about people going up and spraying pepper spray on folks that are trying to go hear Milo speak?
Well, again, I would draw the line at that. I think that is violent when you assault, you know, someone who you disagree with. Blocking them, though, through linked arms, a chain of human protesters, I think that's legitimate. But assault, no, that's not legitimate.
And we don't necessarily know that wasn't provocateurs doing the assault.
it's not legitimate, whoever did it.
Correct.
And that's the problem, of course, with the people who, when they start wearing masks and they're incognito, who are they? Are they people who are genuinely outraged, like most of us, by Trump policies, or are they police agents who are trying to stir things up and create a pretext for further repression? This has happened, unfortunately, throughout the history of protests in this country, and I'm sure many people out there listening to us, including myself, are old enough to remember back to the 60s and 70s when government routinely infiltrated protest movements with provocateurs, and that's their game, to stir things up and then create a pretext for further crackdowns. I mean, look, these people in the Trump White House now are just itching for the next Reichstag fire of their administration.
Or 9/11, David Talbot, because that was also a president that didn't win the popular vote, that had sagging ratings, George W. Bush, and then 9/11 catapulted him into political stardom momentarily and certainly kicked off the so-called war on terror.
Right, and the way that the Trump administration is goading, hour by hour, the Muslim population, not only of this country, but of the entire world, you can only pray that we don't have another terror incident anytime soon. But as soon as we do, yes, you can imagine how they're going to exploit it and ratchet up the kind of madness that they've already been escalating in this country. So we live in such dangerous times now. People are being killed for their religious beliefs, for their race, because of their race, because of their political views. They're being threatened, they're being bullied, they're being targeted, and in many cases by the sort of Milos of the world who go after progressives and people they disagree with in all sorts of extreme ways. And so that's why I say we're not living in a civics textbook world anymore. We're living in a pre-fascist or emerging fascist America. And so my fellow liberals and libertarians who are concerned about pure free speech and protecting that, I understand those concerns. But as I say, unfortunately, that's not the world we live in anymore.
Well, David Talbot, that's exactly where I want to go next. The statement from administrators at UC Berkeley said, quote, "We condemn in the strongest possible terms the violence and unlawful behavior that was on display and deeply regret that those tactics will now overshadow the efforts to engage in legitimate and lawful protest against the performers' presence and perspectives. While Yiannopoulos' views, tactics, and rhetoric are profoundly contrary to our own, we are bound by the Constitution, the law, our values, and the campus's principles of community to enable free expression across the full spectrum of opinion and perspective." And I want to add to that, the statement from the Foundation of Individual Rights in Education, where Greg Lukianoff is head, the legal group that protects free speech and academic freedom on campuses, their statement was the following, quote, "The use of mob violence to respond to constitutionally protected expression is an affront to our nation's liberal traditions, and as so often happens, it has also proven deeply counterproductive, sabotaging its apparent aim. Instead of silencing Yiannopoulos, the violent response ensured that his message was broadcast nationwide." In other words, David Talbot, I would suggest, and I'm making simply an argument, and it's certainly here for all of us to disagree with or however we see it, but censorship backfires. And this is playing right into the playbook of Breitbart, of David Horowitz, where they go and they purposely are provocative. You see now that not only is Yiannopoulos alone, he is with Scarelli, the big pharma guy, right? Remember? So this is like a 1-2 punch of, you know, really toxic, as Michael Levitin said, kind of rhetoric in your face that is bringing these kinds of visceral responses, and maybe rightfully so. But then they're turning around and Yiannopoulos immediately plays the victim card. And this is what David Horowitz has long done. You remember David back from Ramparts, now, of course, far right, front page mag, etc. Another Breitbart kind of thing, far right wing, quote unquote, news outlet. But what are your thoughts about that kind of a perspective on the free speech spectrum, which I know you're also riffing on from the free speech movement on some of the recent posts?
Well, look, liberals and progressives can't win. When they're nice and play by the rules, which unfortunately is all too often the case, like the Democrats in Washington until maybe recently, let's see, we're called wimps and losers and so on. And we are when we play by those nice rules, I believe. And when we're overly aggressive, of course, oh my God, the world is caving in and we're the mob, the unruly mob and all that. But look, these people are ruthless. Our opponents are ruthless people. If we don't get that at this point, then we've got our heads stuck in the sand. These people are out to destroy us. They're out to destroy everything that we hold dear in this country. And if we don't fight back, tooth and nail, fight fire with fire, then we are the losers and the wimps that these people have called us for years. Now, again, there's limits to what you can do and you should do. And I've said that very clearly. And so, yes, when the Black Bloc goes wild in the streets, they're off on their own kind of crazy mission. And they should be excluded and separated in whatever ways we can from the more peaceful but very militant opposition. My green protest would have been everything short of what the Black Bloc did. Encircling the building, chanting loudly, disrupting, making it all but impossible for that occasion to go on. Yes, I'm all for that, because this is a poison that must be stopped, and we must stop it by taking the gloves off, but not through violence. I know that's a very difficult line to draw, but we have to do it. We have to do it if we're going to save this country.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're also joined by the Project Censored Radio program's new senior correspondent, Michael Levitin, who's been doing numerous segments with us. We thank Michael Levitin for joining us on the program. And we're speaking with journalist and author David Talbot. So we're going to continue this conversation about recent events with Milo Yiannopoulos, about the protests against the so-called alt-right or neo-fascist movements. We'll continue that after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin, and we are joined in conversation with author and journalist David Talbot, and we're talking about the massive protests that have been following Milo Yiannopoulos, the Breitbart writer, around the country, recently at UC Berkeley and before that UC Davis. So, Peter Phillips?
I think, David, to bring your point forward here, that we're really in a state of fascism, really. At 3:13 a.m. on February 2nd, Donald Trump tweets, "If UC Berkeley does not allow free speech and practices violence on innocent people with a different point of view, no federal funds." Now, whenever has a president made that kind of a comment on an event happening somewhere in the country? So we have to look at this as a coordinated effort, and certainly one that we have to stand up to. Are you surprised by Trump's tweet?
No, of course not. He's a bully fascist, and that's what bully fascists do, particularly when their own little Hitler youth, Milo Yiannopoulos, gets rushed off campus because we're starting to finally fight back the way we should be. This is what's going to be happening. This is the new norm. This kind of level of combat is what the new America is all about. We have to be prepared for this and gird our loins, and we're in this for the long haul. I just heard about this new call for a general strike, a work stoppage, a national general strike on Friday, February 17th. I heartily endorse those ideas. Francine Crowes, the noted writer, raised this in an article in The Guardian, and I believe that we have to use all sorts of means that are very unusual for most Americans. The way I put it is this: if our government has become the enemy, and it clearly has, then we must become ungovernable.
David, picking up on your point about the Hitler youth, as you say, Milo is sort of a representative, something, you know, channeling from last century. I think you could extend that and say that if the forces did not come out right now to challenge Milo and challenge Breitbart and the entire false media narrative, the alternative fact universe they live in, and physically come into the streets to challenge them, I think you wouldn't be far off in envisioning that Trump himself would call out his own red shirts at some point. And we can probably expect that anyway to happen, whether people resist at this moment or not. we're not so far off of Trump calling on his huge, his so-called giant base of support, though he lost the popular vote by 3 million people. He does consider himself, and he is a man with millions of supporters around the country. It's not unrealistic to think that at some point in the near future, to get policies rammed through despite incredible protest and mass resistance, we're talking, you know, trying to revive the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline and the immense swells of population and protesters and youth and everybody that will be out to reject that. This is kind of a come to Jesus moment, and there's going to probably be more violence than we expect. I wouldn't be surprised if he brings his own minions out and calls out his own red hat, red shirt boys into the streets. So do you see this as maybe preempting? And it really is mirroring Weimar Germany, 1930s Germany, when you had the socialists and the communists in the streets marching against the fascists. It really is a lead up in a sense. But right now, it seems with these protests on university campuses, at least in California, this side, the left, is getting out in front of the aggressive forces of the right that are not yet in the street.
Well, yes, it does call to mind Weimar Germany, I agree, and the sort of street fighting between Hitler's brown shirt and the communists and the socialists and the red shirts. That didn't end well, as we know. Hitler used that street violence and that growing sense of anarchy to, of course, you know, feed on people's fears, the German public's fears, and further consolidate his power. And we have to be concerned about that. Unfortunately, at this point, because he's now the commander-in-chief, he doesn't need his street army. He has the official army, National Guard, and so on. He has enormous repressive power, and he will not stop short of using it. We can be sure of that. That's why I do say I draw the line at violence. You know, I can understand why people really get off on it when a white nationalist pig like Richard Spencer is slugged in the face on the streets of Washington, as he was during Inauguration Week, by a Black Bloc guy.
Or someone dressed like a Black Bloc guy.
Or someone dressed as a Black Bloc guy. I'm sure that felt good to a lot of people, and for obvious reasons. But the problem is that violence starts to spiral, and it can lead, and usually does, to a very dangerous place. So my feeling is, no, get militant and get mobilized, but stop short of that. And it's the masses of people in the streets. It's the people who are refusing to take orders. It's the people disrupting and sabotaging and undermining this extremist president's rule. That's the way we're going to win. We're going to make this country ungovernable in nonviolent ways, and that's what's going to bring him down.
But don't you think, another thought, just really to point in, David, one thing that struck as well, and it came to mind, everyone's reviving the 60s and all these sort of hallmark moments, including the free speech movement, but it came to mind seeing the fire at the campus, seeing the broken windows, and seeing that true violence, as in gunshot violence, may not be far off. It brought to mind Kent State, and wondering more than, Mickey, your point about, you know, what's Trump's 9/11 going to be? What's Trump's Kent State going to be when we have not had in decades a moment in which young people out protesting peacefully get gunned down, get killed? That would shock the American public, and yet it almost feels as though that time may not be far off because things are escalating so quickly and people are so outraged and in face of they're resisting.
Part of canceling this, and the university delayed in canceling it, over 100 faculty members had sent a letter to the chancellor almost a month ago where they cited Yiannopoulos as, when he visited the University of Wisconsin in December, he spoke at his public lecture about a transgender student at the university in derogatory ways. It went so far as to project a picture of this person on the lecture, and at the same time it was broadcast on Breitbart. That is hate speech no matter what. He does not deserve a stage on a public university.
I'm concerned, as you say, about what this administration is capable of, given already his judicial appointments, Trump's. I mean, Jeff Sessions is an extremist who should never have been allowed anywhere near the Justice Department. The man who's now been nominated for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch. We just learned that when he was a preppy at Georgetown Prep School, one of the most elite prep schools in the nation in Washington, he was the president and founder of a student club called Fascism Forever. I mean, these are the kind of like bizarre and extreme people that this administration is filling up its positions with. And so, again, we do not live in normal times. We have to understand that. I know it's difficult for people. We're all still sort of like stupefied, I think, by the events of the past 2 weeks. But we have to absorb the new reality and take the proper steps at this point.
You know, David Talbot, the reason I think Michael Levitin brought up the Kent State issue, there are so many different things that I wanted to spin off of, but I don't want to get off the topic here. But just riffing on that one thread there, definitely we're seeing mass unrest, and we have already been seeing mass violence used against protests, against Native Americans, against activists and other protesters, and that was under Obama. We have been seeing this for years. We saw it against Occupy Wall Street. We're seeing it all over. So it isn't as if there's no precedent for it, and we don't need to go all the way back to Kent State for that. We already seem, I'm going to use this term again, we already seem to be at some level of fever pitch here in the so-called Trump era. It seems that it's kind of a tinderbox, something like what happened recently at UC Berkeley and before at UC Davis, and what's kind of following people like Milo and Breitbart around, which I think is what they want, is the spectacle, right? And they can control this narrative that the left is intolerant and so forth. But I think we're nearing tinderbox moments. What do you think?
Well, exactly. That's why I say it's not just like crying fire in a crowded theater at this point, this kind of hate speech. It's like setting fire to the theater. We are about to blow. Look, even the press guy, Sean Spicer, who's supposed to be the kind of guy who goes out and sort of, you know, makes nice on the press and smooth things over. This guy is like, the new article in the New Yorker just said, he's like a fire hydrant ready to blow.
He's a pit bull.
Yeah. And so there are no new norms. The new norm is scary. That's what we're saying. And I agree that we've seen sort of the levels of repression being ratcheted up even under Obama. I was at Standing Rock. It was a war scene. It was a battleground. I mean, the level of militarized violence there against peaceful protesters was just terrifying.
Now there will be multiple pipeline projects, Keystone being more gigantic in its scope as a pipeline, and the thousands and upon thousands and thousands of people, young people, everyone, and indigenous and families and everyone is going to go out. And will this mean they will need a new level of courage to go because this is Trump, not Obama, who has a kind of a final order on
them? Well, I think that's true, Michael. We will need a new level of courage because we are at war. We are now warriors. You know, one of the saddest things about Standing Rock when I was up there was to see all these veterans, these military veterans who were Native American, who had returned from the battlefields of Afghanistan and Iraq, suffering from PTSD still. And when they saw the helicopters and the Humvees and the kind of like militarized presence that was being directed at them, a lot of them started to go into PTSD shock and have to be treated in the medic tents there. So, yeah, we are at war, and there are going to be casualties, and we've seen this already. There were a number of casualties at Standing Rock. And now with this president, and of course Obama did a timeout near the end of his administration, and we are able to take a breather, but not anymore. Standing Rock is now ground zero, and there'll be many more.
And it seems like there may be more and more, as you say, ground zeros, particularly following around Breitbart and others, particularly with Steve Bannon in the White House, seemingly supporting, possibly even orchestrating these talks, or certainly cheering them on with Milo Yiannopoulos and others. So, David Talbot, thank you so much for joining us on the program today. I know you do a lot of this writing on Facebook. Is there anywhere you could tell listeners where they could read more of you in addition to the San Francisco Chronicle?
I post my San Francisco Chronicle columns on my Facebook page, because you know, Mickey, because you're in there, as a very lively forum where
Indeed.
A lot of these ideas are being thrashed out by the hour. So I invite everyone to come in there.
Thanks so much, David Talbot. Thanks for joining us for this important conversation. It's going to be an ongoing one, and we'll certainly be bringing you back onto the Project Censored show to discuss these things.
My pleasure.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin. In the next segment of the program, we're joined by Arif Humayun, author of Connivance by Silence. Stay with us.
Peace train sounded louder. Ride on the peace train. Come on the peace train. It's peace train. Good friends too, cause it's getting
dying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss? 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a beast train. Oh, beast train, take this country. Come take me home again. Oh, beast train sounding louder.
Ride on the beast train.
Come on.
Arif Humayun is an American citizen, practicing Muslim, and an avid writer. He specializes in comparative religion and has dedicated to understanding what causes radicalism in advancing human rights. He was born in Pakistan, came to the United States in 1980. He's lived all over the world. His newest book is Connivance by Silence, addresses the politically inspired inspirations of Islam that has crept into the Muslim discourse and inspired radicalism. Arif is also the president and co-founder of the Circle of Peace, an international initiative to strengthen the bonds of humanity and compassion across faith communities. He's a fellow in the American Islamic Forum for Democracy and is an active member of the American Islamic Leadership Coalition. Welcome, Arif.
Thank you.
You write in your book that radical extremism, what Trump is pledging to destroy, is a stain on Islam. And is wholly contrary to the proper teachings of Islam and should, in fact, be eliminated by Muslims themselves. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that idea?
Yes, this Islamic radical ideology, this needs to be tackled by Muslims themselves because this is, as you said, a stain on the religion. And let me just give you a very short introduction of the purpose of religion as Muslims understand it. The purpose of religion is to transform human beings, us, from the instinctive stage, which is the very basic stage of humans, to a moral stage where we can differentiate between right and wrong and do justice. And then the ultimate stage is the spiritual stage, where we really don't care about ourselves but care about the society, about other people, and so forth. So the whole teachings of Islam, it's a very simple and very modern religion. The five pillars of Islam are affirmation of the faith, that there's only one God and Muhammad is his messenger, five obligatory prayers a day, fasting for the month of Ramadan, a charity and pilgrimage to Mecca. And if you look at this, these are, I think, are training tools for the individual to achieve the purpose of the faith that I described earlier. Affirmation is a commitment. The five prayers, daily prayers, are essentially discipline, cleanliness, and humility. Fasting is more of the same. And charity on 2.5% of your wealth to help the poor, this is essentially a bigger sacrifice and being part of the society and helping the disadvantaged people. And the pilgrimage is nothing more than a message of unity and equality because everybody is dressed the same and they all do the same things, irrespective of if somebody is rich or poor, black or white or whatever. And then the other part of the Muslim faith are the six articles of faith, which essentially are belief in one God and all the angels. And the angels that Muslims believe in are the same as biblical angels. A belief in all the prophets and belief in all the revealed books. And five of them are mentioned in the Quran, scrolls of Abraham, the book of Moses called Torah, Psalms of David, Gospel of Jesus, and the Quran that came down on Prophet Muhammad. And predestination, that the people will be born, they'll die, and then there's life after death. But in between the birth and death, we have to use a gray matter to understand what's going on and how to conduct ourselves. That's essentially what religion is. But notice that the topics of jihad, sharia, blasphemy, apostasy are all missing in the teachings of the faith. These are all made up by the radical ideology, which is a politicized version of religion that was essentially propagated about 100 years ago after the First World War. And just to move on to the agenda of the Islamists, their whole objective is to create an Islamic state, create an Islamic caliphate, a political caliphate. And this is based on the foundations of Sharia, which essentially is a law that gives them power to control people's behavior. Jihad is a violent interpretation that they have created themselves.
apostasy that restricts people's freedom to choose, and blasphemy, which restricts people's freedom of expression. So that is the Islamist agenda. And if you need, I can elaborate further on the differences between the religion and the political interpretation. Islam is not a political message. It is for individuals to transform themselves and society, for establishing peace in the society based on freedoms and morality. It promotes piety and also creates an environment for peace, equality, and justice. The radical interpretation, on the other hand, promotes their ideology as a political system, and they claim they have a solution to every conceivable problem, but that has to be determined by the politicized clergy. No, people like you and I cannot do that. And the goal is to establish the Islamic State, which I just described, and they promote religiosity and not piety, and they enforce religious practices and have severe punishments for what they deem to be crimes, but those things are essentially sanctioned by the faith.
Harith, you describe what the history of jihad and that wasn't necessarily violent. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, jihad in the scripture allows a defensive war only, and that is not only to protect the Islamic faith, but for all religions. But there are three different forms of jihad, the lowest one being a defensive war. The higher forms of jihad is a jihad against our own egos. That is what is preferred. In fact, there's one tradition that the Prophet is telling his followers that we are going from a minor jihad, which was a defensive war, to a greater jihad, that means against our own egos and against our own selves, to overcome anger and greed and those sort of things, and to help transform us into a better human being so we can help the society that we are in.
You write about the 1.5 billion Muslims in the world and that a very small percentage are radical extremists,
yes.
But they've gotten a huge amount of attention and have been in some cases encouraged, certainly by the U.S. in Afghanistan against Russia. So what responsibility do the 1.5 billion Muslims have to sort of weed out the radicals?
Each one of us Muslims has responsibility to reject this ideology. And the problem that I see is that the Muslim world is largely uneducated or very low levels of education. And education does not mean going to school and college, but it means to be able to decipher the information and make choices between what they consider right and wrong. The Muslim world is primarily busy with this religiosity. They would dress up in a certain way, which is largely cultural. They would speak in a different way, in a certain way, and just memorize information that they get, but not be critical of what they are being told. And the source of information for many in the Muslim world, most of them live in the third world countries, is through the cleric in the mosque, or through local print media, which has to cater to whatever the audiences are. So I think each of us has to understand what the faith is. And also I would mention that while the scripture is in Arabic, it's old classical Arabic, there are many translations and many commentaries available. And the quality of the translation and the quality of the commentary depends on the knowledge of the translator or the commentator. The translations have no major issues, but when it goes into commentary, then some of the commentaries I've seen, they are just nothing more than fairy tales. I mean, they just go into different areas to make the point, and at times they are just wrong, and that is where many people get their ideas from. And they don't look at other people's interpretations, and they just limit themselves to the one interpretation and close their minds in a way. And just to give you an example, there's one place in the Quran which talks about locking fire in stone. The common interpretation of that was meant to be flint. But now we know radioactivity, we know uranium, we know all these materials, so that could be another meaning of the same words. And another place related to this is that they talk about a fire that burns from the inside, does not affect the outside. And nuclear radiation could also be inferred from that. So this is how the meaning of the Quran changes over time. The words stay the same, but based on our own knowledge, we can extend the understanding. But people limit themselves to the old translation, whatever they're used to, And that is one of the problems. If you look at the religion of Islam, there are many sects, about 6 dozen sects within them. Each one of them says that they have monopoly over the faith. They are right. Everybody else is wrong. The same is true with other faiths, but I'm just talking about Islam here. So we have to get out of those silos that we are in and just look at the big picture and then understand what we are supposed to be doing. And just in terms of the violence that we see, the Quran talks about killing one innocent individual to be like killing the entire humankind, and saving one innocent life as saving the entire humankind. So this is the extent of compassion and the extent of value of human life in Islam. Yet the terrorists or radical people, they just kill indiscriminately and just justify their actions by whatever words they use.
So you're saying that terrorism is certainly contrary to Islam and the Quran and morally wrong?
Absolutely.
We're speaking with Arif Humayun, author of Connivance by Silence. He is a co-founder and president of the Circle of Peace, and he joins us today on the Project Censored show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. So, Arif, can you talk a little bit more specifically about strategies of nonviolence? Is that playing a role here in what you're dealing with, and can you talk more about how you manifest this?
The strategies for nonviolence, I mean, they were demonstrated by the Prophet himself. For example, first of all, when he migrated from his birthplace called Mecca to another place called Medina, which is about 200 miles away, he was invited there to help the other tribes, which were pagan and Christian and Jewish tribes, to resolve their feuds. So he came up with what is commonly known as the Constitution of Medina, which essentially reads like a Nero Charter. I mean, it talks about collective defense. Nobody is forced to change the faith. Nobody is required to do anything different other than give up the feuds, the long feuds and revenge, and give up bloodshed. That is all that was required, and they agreed for collective defense. There was no Sharia at that time. That is more important. So that is one example. The other example is that after he had come back to Mecca, and he came back to Mecca with 10,000 people, and not one single person was killed in combat in that operation. And in his last sermon, he told the gathering that everybody is equal. All men are equal, and black, white, or yellow, or brown does not make any difference. And he said that God has made the life, property, and honor of every man sacred. And in fact, he did say there, to take any man's life or his property or to attack his honor is unjust and wrong. I mean, this is a very strong statement he made. And he also said that men and women have equal rights. And the other interesting thing I'd like to tell you is that in 1964, I believe, there was a book published that cross-referenced every article of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted in 1948, to the Quran. And yet, the sad part is that about 1990, the OIC, which is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, many of the members had signed this declaration, but in 1990, they turned around and said this declaration is against Islam because it does not include Sharia. And they adopted another declaration, which is referred to as the Cairo Declaration. And so this is the irony of things, that in 64, the people are saying every article is consistent. In 1990, they are turning around and saying this is not Islamic. So what do you do about such things? And OIC is a 56 or 57 member group of Muslim countries, which is led by Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And Pakistan did sign the declaration in 1948. So this is the issue that we are dealing with.
Arif, you describe in your book as Pakistan being kind of the center of radical Islam, and it's branched out from there, but certainly had its role in the war in Afghanistan when Russia was involved. And now we have Trump pledging to destroy radical Islam, banning immigrants from the seven countries of the world, mostly Islamic, that we are bombing. Is that a provocation that will continue to create a challenge to Muslims worldwide?
It certainly is, because force cannot change minds or ideologies. And just going back to your question, the radical ideology started out in Egypt in 1928 after the Ottoman Empire was defeated in the First World War. And the Muslim Brotherhood raised the demand of having an Islamic State. The Ottoman Empire was considered to be an Islamic State, despite the fact that there were two other states which existed. One was in India, a Mughal Empire, and the other one was in Iran. But because of the caliphate, which had become political by that time, Turkey was regarded as the Islamic State. And I would say it for wrong reasons. But anyway, when the Turks were defeated, or prior to the defeat, the caliphate, Ottoman caliphate, sent emissaries out to the Muslim world. And one guy came to India as well. This is before the partition into India and Pakistan. And they sought support from the people so that they would preserve the caliphate. But when Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, he took over, he abolished the caliphate. But that had started a movement in India in which even Gandhi participated, because Gandhi's goal was, this is the founder of India, Mahatma Gandhi, his goal was to unite Hindus and Muslims. But that backfired, and that alienated the people and also caused this radical ideology to sink in. But then at about the same time, because India was also trying to get rid of the British colonizers at that time, there was another individual who was a journalist, but he became a scholar and a leader and formed a political party. He also picked up on the demand for the Islamic State, and he, in fact, justified jihad as justified the use of force under jihad to create the Islamic State, and his name was Maulana Maududi. And his party is essentially responsible for this ideology to creep into Pakistan. But there are other events and divided India. I should also mention those. The clergy was opposed to the partition of India for whatever reason. After the country was partitioned, these guys had no need to be in India, so they came back to Pakistan and pledged to serve the religion and not take part in politics. And they disrupted the first Constituent Assembly's proceedings, because the question they were debating was whether they should adopt the parliamentary form of government or the presidential form. And the question that was being discussed was, should president be sovereign or the prime minister? These guys said God can be sovereign and no human can be sovereign. So that derailed the process. And then the parliament adopted a compromise resolution, commonly known as the Objective Resolution, saying that all laws framed in the country will conform to Islam. That is now part of the Constitution. But that is a slippery slope because of the divisions between the people. If one party were to frame a law, the others would claim this is un-Islamic. So the parliament is essentially paralyzed for making any meaningful legislation in that country.
So radicalism fits into that ideology that we're going to follow the laws of God. The states can decide that.
Yes.
And then that can run counter to, like, human rights.
Absolutely.
And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was not accepted by Sharia law. Is that correct?
Well, the Sharia law is also very interesting. Let me describe how it came around. The Sharia law we're talking about is not in the Quran. This is legislative Sharia that was developed by the Abbasid Caliphate back in the 8th and 9th century. Abbasid Caliphate was a very large country, and it had all sorts of people, and it was expanding its boundaries. So they wanted to have a unified law which they could apply across to the entire population. But the other important thing to remember is that it was not a static law. They hired scholars to frame the law. They asked them to consult the Quran and then come up with the law, but they could not do it. So then they started looking at other sources, and about 200 years after the Prophet's death, they started compiling what he did or what he may have done or what he may have said. And some of those stories they collected were genuine, but some of them were not. And so then they looked at whatever they had. They still could not frame the law. And then they started using precedents and analogy and reasoning to frame the law, using the principles of the Quran, which were equality, peace, and justice. And it was a dynamic system, because at any time there were multiple interpretations of what came out. Because today there are four major schools of thought in the Sunni Islam. At that time there were about two or three dozen schools of thought, and each one of them contested the decisions or the choices. So it was an ever-changing set of laws which was updated regularly to cater to the changing environment, social and cultural. But the foundation had to be on justice, peace, and equality. But the other important thing is that the Abbasid Caliphate was a collection of many independent entities who paid homage to them. So there was inbuilt separation of framing the law by the caliphate and its implementation by the independent political entity that existed under them. But in today's case, the demands of these radical clergy is that they would frame the law and they would implement it themselves, which is, again, something that is not good.
Arif, in your book, Connivance by Silence, you're implying that Muslims worldwide are not stepping up to the plate, so to speak, in regards of challenging radical Islam, challenging Sharia law in a more direct, open way, and that the religion itself offers great hope for individuals to make their own moral choices following the pillars that you talked about of the faith. So what is your prescription here? What should people be doing? What should Muslims be doing actively today in the world?
My suggestion to my co-religionists and friends is that they should understand the faith themselves and not rely on people's interpretation. And the simplest thing is to look at the multiple explanations, multiple translations and commentaries around them and just see what fits in the modern system that we live in. The bigger thing that we have not done, the Muslims have not done, is that they could not transform their economies and intellect from the agrarian system that the Sharia law grew in back in the time of the Abbasid Caliphate. Today we are living in an industrial age, so we haven't transformed our thinking from that agrarian to the industrial era, and that is where the shortcoming is. But that is nothing to do with the faith. I think each individual, and my own example, I was transferred to Australia, and that's where somebody challenged me about my faith, and I had knew nothing about my faith. I was born in the Muslim faith, but I went to a Catholic school. So then I started understanding, searching on my own. This is back in 1989, and then I started researching, understanding my faith, and that's how I started, you know, these things, to write about these things, explain them to other people. So I guess the Muslims have to critically understand, review the faith and see how it fits with the radical interpretation. And many people would, on a private level, reject it. But the issue is that the laws in Muslim countries are so restrictive, they do not allow condemnation of these ideologies, and that's called blasphemy. I mean, if you look at people who have raised their voices against these unjust ideologies, they are murdered to the extent that the governor of the largest province in Pakistan, he made a comment that the blasphemy law needs to be revised. His guard killed him, point blank range. And after a lot of political maneuvering, his guard was convicted. The judge that convicted him had to leave the country. And then he was hanged, and now they have built a big mausoleum for him. And people are coming and donating, making big financial donations, and they want to start a madrasa in there. This is in the capital of Pakistan, Islamabad. So this is the extent of suppression of expression, and this is not helping anybody, just helping the clergy. This is bread and butter for them, so they don't want to give up. It's a very, very serious situation. I think what we have to do is, sitting here, we can discuss these things freely and promote human rights and equal rights for everybody so people can speak up. I'm concerned about the future generation. If they don't get this message, they would be locked into the same silos that the previous generations are, and they might not be able to look at the big picture. And this is not going to help the Muslims at all. We have to be open and discuss them openly and in a positive, objective manner.
Arif Humayun, you are also a co-founder and president of the Circle of Peace. You're a fellow at the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. We have a few minutes left here, and I just wanted to have you have the opportunity to tell the listeners about what you do in those capacities.
The Circle of Peace is a grassroots movement. It started out after I wrote a rather lengthy white paper on radicalism back, I think it was 2006 or 7, when the terrorists attacked the hotels in India, in Bombay. I stayed at those places. In fact, my wife and I were there that summer when the attack occurred. So I wrote this lengthy paper and distributed it as far as I could. And there was a Christian priest in our city who saw this, and he talked to me about it. Then he brought a Jewish guy, and he said, "This is the sort of information that we have not seen before." So we, four or five of us, got together and we formed a Circle of Peace. So we do discuss these difficult topics and publish on these topics, and our website has all the publications. We also hold seminars annually where we invite different faith groups to come and talk to a common topic from the scriptures. So we don't say who is good or bad, but we just talk about the topic. Like, for example, our next seminar is on the 13th of February at George Fox University, and that's going to talk about building bridges through education. And we have a Jewish rabbi, a Buddhist Christian, and a Muslim speaker talking about what our religion requires us to do to promote education and build bridges with other people. So that's essentially what we do. Have a website.
Could you give the website?
www.circleofpeaceonline.org.
Thank you so much, Arif Humayun. Your work, Connivance of Silence, thank you so much for your taking time out of your day for a discussion to share this work, and important work in your trying to understand radicalization and also advance human rights. Thanks for joining the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you very much.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. Thank you for joining us today. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips and Michael Levitin. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Also, come visit and see what we do online at www.projectcensored.org. We'll see you next time.
Ritualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times when the master thief can find and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip the brothers in our system.